Hello, welcome back to the Good News Show. Yes, we're back with more news and views on the news from the Christian worldview point of view. And here with me, joining me all the way from sunny Englandistan, is James Byers. How's it doing down there?
Very good, Effendi.
Yes, thank you.
I'm all right, thank you. In fact, I've had a bit of an injury.
Oh.
I sliced my thumb open yesterday on a serrated knife.
Okay. Now,
something to do, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, I know that these sort of suicide packs are all the rage these days, but normally you're meant to blow people up, not just destroy a tin can. You know, I think you're... Well, try harder next time. That's all I'm saying.
I will. Yeah.
Now,
how are you?
Yeah, I'm really well. And the weather's improving even in the north of England. I'll tell you, it's actually saw the sun behind a cloud the other day. I thought it had disappeared.
Really?
But, yep. So.
I hope people don't flood your church thinking the world's ending up north. What is this great ball we've seen in the sky?
Yes. We've been looking at elections around the world with increasing horror, really, at the people who vote for, and also the candidates that are on offer. And the French presidential election did not disappoint in this regard. Marine Le Pen and I forgot his first name now, Macron. What was his first name? Emmanuel Macron. I've got it written in front of me here in my notes here. Yes, Emmanuel Macron. Now, it would not be my ideal choice for president, but neither would Marine Le Pen. So it was sort of like a bit of a difficult choice if I were there. It seems that it was an easy choice for the French electorate. Macron won 66.1% and Le Pen won 33.9%. There were just two of them, so that makes sense. Now, here in this report, which I'm taking from the Independent, says that, well, that's not quite the whole story. You see, the thing is, if you take into account all the electorate, all the people who could have voted, then there were 47.5 million registered voters, and 25% of them didn't vote for either of the candidates. Yeah. But some of them, some of the electorate... 8.6% of them, this is in addition to the 25%, another 8.6% of people did vote, but they spoiled their ballot in some way or left it blank. That means that the people abstaining was 12.1 million, which is more than voted for Le Pen. So she didn't really come second. She didn't really come second, she came third. She came third to people who didn't want either of them. That's interesting. But what I wanted to highlight here for us to talk about on the Good News Show is, what does this mean today? Because this seems to be an increasing trend. People just don't want to vote. The only sort of blip that I would say is we seem to have quite a good turnout for the Brexit referendum. But for voting for an actual party, people just don't want to vote. What is it? What is it about these? What do you think? Is it the actual politicians themselves? Are they lying too much? Or is it the way that government doesn't seem to be having much impact on our daily lives? What is it? I mean, we went and voted, so why don't people vote?
Yeah, I think it's sort of all of the above. And I think... if it's an issue, like if it's Brexit, if it's the Scottish referendum, mm-hmm. if it's a thing that people can get passionate about or angry about, then I think it's fine. But then that's one issue. That's what people vote for. But I think there has been such a disillusionment in politics and politicians going probably back to the infamous invasion of Iraq. Depending on your point of view, we were either lied to and therefore we couldn't trust any of them. And therefore, I don't think, certainly in the UK, I don't think politics has recovered from that. And I don't think, in many ways, I don't think politics has either recovered from the expensive scandal of few years back. But having said that, I think for people to vote, I think it's vital. And I think if you don't vote, what are you saying? Does that then sort of, can you then change anything? Can you then complain? Can you then start anything? If you go and in some ways I kind of see, personally, I see ruining your ballot paper as almost worse as not turning up at all. Because I kind of think, well, you waste your own time by going and queuing. But I think, I mean, have we ever trusted politicians since we've become news and media savvy? Ever over the last sort of 40 or 50 years, when people have learned how the media works, has there ever really been a big trust in politicians? Probably not. I mean, I think, you know, going back to the 60s, the Perfumo thing, the first big, I think, political scandal we had, some would say it's been broken since then, that 53, 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think that it's got worse, or hopefully, it was because of shows like ours and having a small effect, but some of the internet outlets that operate in the political sphere, commentators, and some journalists who actually go and find out fresh facts. They're independent people these days who have their own channel, sometimes their own site, sometimes a YouTube channel. There's one called Timcast where this guy called Tim, I believe, goes out. For example, he's on the streets of Paris when there were riots against Macron's being elected because of he's perceived as being a corporatist, you know, being a Goldman Sachs chap. He was out on the streets. So a lot of these more trusted news sources are now not the mainstream media. And so people moving away from the mainstream media, which is easier to influence by politicians, particularly those with a lot of money who are in power, that sort of thing. So we're getting to see behind the scenes. We trust people who tell us things that they don't want us to know. So I think it is making it worse for politicians. In a way, that's a good thing, because it's good that we know. But it's, you see, it's a problem that people don't trust the process. You see, my opinion is this, that seeing that people don't turn up, but that many people don't want to choose either candidate, so they spoil the ballot.
Mm.
I think the time has come to put on the option of, we don't want either of them, we want a revote. And so if that one wins, well, it wouldn't have done in this case, so, you know, it wouldn't have hindered the process. But if it were possible to have a revote, it might encourage people to get more involved, and it would encourage the politicians to get their act together, because they haven't got to just get through; they've got to actually convince people they're worth it. And going, I guess, having a revote in the French presidential election case would mean going back to the start of the process with all the candidates back in. Except for these two, because they didn't, you know. They weren't wanted.
Yeah.
So something like that, something where you can actually say, oh, I don't like any of these, let's start again,
I think, but I think as Christians, I think it's vital for humans to go and vote. But I think as Christians, I think we should all vote, and whether we're Christian or not, we will all be held to account yes. one day. But I think as Christians, while we are here, we need to be good stewards of the world. So I think we all need to vote, and I think we need to vote prayerfully and carefully. And I think listen to everything, read everything, because therefore, you know, then we can influence change for the greater good. And that doesn't necessarily mean voting a Christian politician just because they're Christian. Their faith might be secure, but everything they say might be complete rubbish. And a non-Christian might be excellent. But we need to use our faith in everything we do.
Yes.
And I think that encourages anything as simple as sort of, what am I going to go and shop, spend my money on? Right down to the vital things of, who do I want my government to be?
Yeah.
You know, sort of, what is my health? Who am I going to marry? Who am I going to vote for? It should be in everything. So especially in potentially life-changing or circumstantial changes that whatever sort of, you know, new government may bring, or a revamped government on a second term.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily think, I mean, I mentioned earlier about general distrust in politicians. I don't necessarily, you know, I think there is also just a general apathy. While they might not necessarily have done anything to turn us against them lately, because Iraq was a while ago, the big financial scandal was a while ago. However, they haven't done a lot, in my view, to win us back either. So I think it's apathy, but I will certainly be voting in our elections, as should you all.
Yes.
Vote.
Yes, please vote. Maybe it'd be a subject for another show, who to vote for.
This is from Christian Headlines. Indonesia took a huge leap backwards in its reputation as a moderate Islamic democracy today when a court sentenced the Christian governor of Jakarta, apologies for the surely wrong mispronunciation, but Basuki Panama, he's been sentenced to 2 years for blasphemy. He's blaspheming against the Quran. As the accusation was key in his defeat in court to be re-elected as the governor of Jakarta. The extremist groups were opposed to having a non-Muslim lead the city, and they organised massive demonstrations. Anyway, the two-year sentence he's got was shocking, as prosecutors had recommended a two-year probation. The law allows a maximum sentence of 5 years for blasphemy. Five judges said he was convincingly proven of blasphemy, a guilty of blasphemy. He was taken to Sipinang prison, and he's the latest victim in one of the world's blasphemy laws. He said he's going to appeal, and it stems from a video that appeared last September when he was telling voters they were being deceived if they believed a specific verse in the Quran prohibited Muslims from voting for a non-Muslim leader. And he said, you don't have to vote for me because you've been lied to with a verse in the Quran. So that's your right. If you feel you can't vote for me because you feel you go to hell because you've been lied to or fooled, no worries. That's your own right. Yeah, so he's been sentenced for 2 years and the maximum is five. And there were street protests against him over the last 6 months. And hardline Muslims have been demonstrating against him, and there's a hardline movement rising up in Indonesia. Now, I know Indonesia had sort of quite harsh sort of prison regimes, but I didn't really sort of realise that they had a hard right. Mind you, I suppose every country does. Even we had, you know, hard right with our National Front and stuff. But Indonesia, that's sort of, it's quite surprising and a little bit shocking.
Well, yes, Indonesia has been turning to more of this, more hardline Islamic state. it was in the past known as being reasonably moderate, as you were hinting there, but it does seem to have changed. And I've noticed a few stories coming out over the years of them clamping down on things like this. For example, from the words that you've said, that he said, that it doesn't even seem to be criticising the Quran, just saying that you've been lied to. It may not even be the Quran. It's the interpretation of it, he seems to be saying. You know, saying that it's wrong to say that the Quran is saying don't vote for a Muslim. Now, I have a slight problem with this in that one of the things that I think is important to do, I know people, some people are comfortable with this, is to deride and laugh at Islam. And the reason for this is because it's a really stupid thing to believe. All the stuff. So if you don't laugh at it, you know, what can you laugh at? I mean, it's just ridiculous. But also, it's one of the main ways of shocking people into seeing that their beliefs are wrong when you ridicule it. So I'm not saying deliberately insulting. And that wouldn't work at all. It's got to be thoughtful criticism, a thoughtful poking fun. The Charlie Hebdo cartoons of Muhammad sewing him naked and engaged in anal sex.
Oh, yes.
Now, that's not very thoughtful, is it? I mean, that's just insulting. So that's not not so amusing. However, some of the amusing stuff with camels that they did, him doing strange with camels, actually that's reasonable because he did have strange things about what you do with camels and drinking camel urine and strange things. I'm not so familiar with Islamic beliefs, but something to do with that. You know, if any of our listeners or viewers know exactly what he teaches about it, please keep it to yourself because it's ridiculous, I would say. But, you know, but certainly Islam, I think, should be degraded, was the phrase. Insulted? No, not insulted, but degraded, yes, and laughed at and ridiculed. I think it's important to do that. Now, I understand that in their country you can't do that, but I just think that they're wrong. I guess he didn't think he was taking the risk because he thought he was just saying, hey, you don't have to vote for me. Look, you know, so it sounded like he was doing himself down. So what do we make of the fact, okay, that's in Indonesia. What do you make of the fact that Stephen Fry was being investigated for blasphemy? Now, for our American listeners, and the majority of our listeners and viewers are in America, you may not know who Stephen Fry is. He was a well-known comedian over here. I mean, quite funny, but more liked, I suppose. He's just a likable character, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, they get Blackadder.
Oh, yeah, he's one of the people on Blackadder. He plays the general in the Blackadder set in the First World War.
Yeah.
So that's the guy and he played Jeeves in the classic series with Hugh Laurie. Yeah. So you may know him from that. He's put on a bit of weight since those days, but he is more or less the same character. And one of the things about him is he doesn't like organised religion because he, as a homosexual man, believes that they're out to get him. And he says insulting things about God. Now, he says ill thought through, just rather silly things. I think that he's heard from some other people. It doesn't seem to be, like I was saying, a good critique. But he is laughing at Christianity in the same way as I recommended laughing at Islam. So what are we to make about this? This is what he said. He was interviewed by, this is a homosexual man, interviewed by one of the best known interviewers in Ireland, who's called Gay Byrne. And I'm not making
it
up.
Oh, he's on the Late Show.
Yes. And I'm not
still going, wow.
Well, that was in 2015. He was still going then, yeah. Yes, Gay Byrne, who is, he's also a sort of likeable chap. And as I understand it, not gay, that's just the name. Although he might burn, I don't know. But he was asked questions about his beliefs. And he said, Fry said to Byrne, he can never respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world full of injustice. Well, neither could I. But he is saying that that's a good description of the Christian God. What do we make of this? He was taken to the police. Oh, there was a complaint made to the police, rather. I don't think he personally went had to go before them. But one man complained to the police under the 2009 blasphemy law, and he thought it was his civic duty to report it. And the Garda, the police, investigated it. Now, they haven't continued it. They haven't taken any further. They just looked into it, said there wasn't enough to prosecute. So what do you think of that? Should he have been prosecuted for that? Was this beyond the pale? I mean, should the police have pursued it further? Calling God capricious, mean-minded and stupid. Is Fry guilty as charged, Your Honour?
No, because that's his thought, and he's known to have been an atheist or non-believer. So I don't think it's a legal matter. But as far as his actual blasphemy goes, that is between him and God. And whether he finds faith in God or lives the rest of his life without God, you know, there's going to be a pretty sort of interesting conversation for him on sort of Judgment Day. Now, I think, you know, the sort of the blasphemy laws, if we then say, well, throwing this chap in prison for 5 years because he insulted Islam and took a bit of the Quran is ridiculous, I then couldn't say, yes, throw Stephen Fry in prison. I mean, I could throw him in prison for not wanting to do another Blackadder, but not for blasphemy. No, but in terms of blasphemy, I think it's not a legal matter. I mean, in the Old Testament, and I suppose probably it would have been a legal matter here, and quite a serious one up until not that long ago.
Yes.
But I think it's a matter for his heart and a matter for God. I find blasphemy offensive. However, people can still say it because not everyone believes God exists. Not everyone believes in God. It doesn't mean I like it. Doesn't mean I agree. And I think it's between a person and God. But it's not going to stop me being a fan of Stephen Fry.
No. In his defense, I would just say that he was answering the question, if God existed, that's what he'd say. Mm. He doesn't believe in God. So this was an argument for the non-existence of God. If he existed, he couldn't possibly be good because of this. So I would say it's not really blasphemy under the normal definition, because he was talking about God in a hypothetical manner, as he doesn't believe in him. So I think that your point about him not believing, so how absurd is it? Well, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. But I was just going to add that the blasphemy law was updated in Ireland because it was just about Christian blasphemy, and it was updated to protect all religions against offence. So it's a slippery slope. You know, what if he were to insult some Muslims? Would it be so easy for the case to be dropped?
No, because for some reason you just can't insult Islam. I don't know what this uproar is. I mean, we just have, and I've quite said before, you know, I said rather flippantly, someone, you know, once said to me, well, surely you must think there is some good in Islam and some good in the Quran, which I said, yeah, namely the bits they nicked from the Bible. But, you know, I don't know what it is. You just can't say anything against it because people do get such an answer. Oh, you can't say that. Yet Christians kind of have to display a turn of the other cheek.
Yes.
And I don't know. It's a huge double standard. I mean, if God exists, and you couldn't believe in a stupid God, well, God doesn't make mistakes. I think the only, you know, I mean, he regretted creating humans, which is why the flood happened. But was that a mistake, or was that humanity's own fault?
Well, yes. I mean, well, of course, yes. The point is that we need to take responsibility for our own actions, and he could have destroyed us. Yeah. I mean, he went as far as arranging the flood and everything. Well, perhaps Stephen Fry should pop over to Indonesia and have a word with them about his thoughts on God and how stupid he is. If he does, then I look forward to hearing back from him from the different parts of the country they've placed his dismembered parts. Now, what are we to make of these reports then from the Smithsonian Channel, which talks about a stone tablet which is believed to confirm the biblical Tower of Babel? The Tower of Babel, of course, well known in the Bible as an expression of man's great pride and his challenge to God. He's as good as God, or better than God, building a huge tower which would reach up to the heavens. Now, this the Smithsonian Channel's show, in its first episode of the new season, spotlights this stone tablet discovered in Babylon. Of course, you know, the same word from Tower of Babel, Babylon, the country associated with it. This stone tablet was discovered 100 years ago, and it's believed to confirm the existence of the biblical Tower of Babel as it's described in the book of Genesis. So it's confirming the account in the Bible. But now they say that they've got new evidence on the surface of this tablet, discovered all that time ago, is an image that reveals what the Tower of Babel looked like. The tablet's about 600 BC, so it's a bit late, isn't it, for the Tower of Babel, I think. But, you know.
Yes.
Well, the stone bears ancient writing, which, when translated, reads, "The Ziggurat Temple Tower of the City of Babylon." So maybe it wasn't contemporaneous, but it does throw a light on what people perhaps still remembered as being the Great Tower. It's interesting, isn't it? Because this the Tower of Babel is in the Bible, and we know in the Bible we're told by some people, not many scholars, but by some people, it's actually all made up and not full of facts. And yet here we have some further proof that the Bible is correct in its historical record, as if we needed any. But what do you make of this then? This the Tower of Babel, was the Tower of Babel this massive structure? Was it real? People building this thing, hoping to reach up to heaven?
Yes. Well, I don't see. Obviously, anyone who has read or looked into the Bible would know that some of it is just factual history. Mm-hmm. That's all there is to it. Some of it is metaphor. Some of it is poetry. But with something like the Tower of Babel, quite often stories were used as a sort of as a sort of general rule for humanity and the way things happened. But I don't see why not. My expertise on Old Testament history and archaeology isn't great, so I admit that. But something like the Tower of Babel, something like any ancient city, we've covered on this show a couple of times, they found locations of battle. We've spoken about something they found about King David. We've spoken about a few things over time. So why not?
Yeah.
Now, how tall was the Tower of Babel? We don't know, because humans were probably generally quite smaller then. But I think, yeah, why not? Why not, as Genesis was written?
Yeah, so it's interesting that here are the key features that make it interesting. It appears to have seven tiers. That's okay. It's not quite up to modern standards of a skyscraper, but that's quite tall. It clearly identifies the man behind it as King Nebuchadnezzar II, you know, Nebuchadnezzar of Bible fame. So it's clear in its confirmation of the Bible account. And it's a tall building, an attempt to reach heaven, and it fell down.
Yeah.
I mean...
But then again, you know, look at the stone. It's not that big.
Yes.
So they couldn't have drawn a picture of it up to heaven, but I you know, the intent was to build it up to heaven.
Oh yeah. Maybe it was intended to be higher than seven tiers.
Yeah. So we won't know. But I think, you know, when I find stuff like this on the Old Testament, I do find it fascinating, and I wish I knew more about the archaeology and history. But then I think to myself, well, why not just learn, look into it, start studying? But I always get excited at further proof, particularly Old Testament stuff, because you can't really doubt Jesus. You can't really doubt Paul. You can't really doubt things they found. But from the Old Testament, I just think, great, things that tie into creation, things that tie into antiquity, that's where I think, great.
Well, when we get a few more paid subscribers on the VidMe channel, we'll perhaps put the cash together and go off for a fact-finding tour in the Middle East, shall we? Or do we need to wait for things to settle down a bit more? I think you'd be waiting forever if you did that. But it's interesting, if we just finally, we wanted to close off with this, so let's just move on. There's this sort of related in that the Tower of Babel was, of course, a great symbol of anti-God sentiment in the time of the Old Testament. Now, moving up to the 20th century, Chairman Mao in China saw himself as a great leader of an atheist country, but he also clearly from his writings saw himself as like one of the great heroes of ancient Chinese writing. So although he was atheistic, he saw himself in sort of godlike terms, it seems. Now, in the same place that Mao launched his great proletarian cultural revolution, as it's translated into English, in the 60s, in which he severely persecuted all religious and political organisations, very few religious groups were untouched by this brutal, brutal campaign, which was a way of just consolidating his power. Churches were destroyed, temples were destroyed. It certainly wasn't just Christianity. Catholics, priests were beaten, or they were all sent off to very harsh labour camps. And right at that spot, there's this massive, massive church being built. bigger than the biggest statue of Mao Zedong. The Xingsha Church is part of a $617 million Christian-themed ecological park, so it's not just the church, and there's a massive structure with a cross on top at the spot where Mao launched this cultural revolution. Now, that is good news.
Yeah, that's awesome, and I think that's... it's obviously Mao's been gone for some time, but I think it's... symbolically, I think it's a great... it's a great move and a great symbol against oppression. Now, China is still technically communist.
Yes.
But I think things like this, I think it's great. And I think when it, you know, it's a sort of bigger sign against oppression and against a changing world. Obviously, parts of the world it's changing for worse. But when sort of Christ can get his own stamp in a place, I just think excellent. And the more he is there and the more people can sort of turn to him there, I think great, then that will surely lead to change for good. I think it's great. I mean, I think specifically there, I think it speaks volumes.
Yeah.
You know,
so, yeah, we end the good news show with some good news. So let's leave it there and wish blessings upon all our listeners from all of us here, from James, from Pete, from the technical crew. Blessings to you.